Welcome to the Working Robots Podcast. The following is a conversation with Michael Littman and David Ackley. They are both academics in computer science with expertise in artificial intelligence and machine learning. Michael is a professor at Brown University and an expert in machine learning, reinforcement learning, and decision making under uncertainty. David is an emeritus associate professor at the University of New Mexico who studies neural networks, machine learning, evolutionary algorithms, and artificial life, and biological approaches to security, architecture, and models of computation. This episode offers a perspective of academic experts who have done a lot of work and research behind the scenes of the self-driving car technology.
Oh, I'm Michael Littman, and I don't know if I'll always be on, but I think I'm a guest today.
And I'm Dave Ackley. I'm another guest.
Yeah, and so Michael Littman and Dave Ackley are both computer science professors. Dave Ackley is a professor at the University of New Mexico, and Michael Littman is a professor at Brown University.
Though I think Dave is now retired. Though he might be emeritus.
Emeritus okay. Professor. At
there UNM, we go. So he's totally a professor.
At large.
We're kind of just to start us off, we are kind of focusing on how different industries are going to be impacted by robots and artificial intelligence. So we're going to be focusing on autonomous vehicles today. So maybe to start us off, maybe each of you tell us a little about what you think about autonomous vehicles in terms of what is an autonomous vehicle? How does that differ from what kind of exists today as normal vehicles?
Cool. So let me start off by saying that I think it's useful to think about an autonomous vehicle, like sometimes people will say self-driving car, as a kind of robot, essentially. So it's the combination of a vehicle, a car or a truck or a bus, combined with the sort of software that perceives the environment around it, makes decisions, and then acts on those decisions by, for example, turning the steering wheel, applying the brakes, putting down the accelerator, that sort of thing. So it's a kind of robot, but it's a robot that specifically is about transportation. It's about getting the vehicle from point A to point B safely.
Okay.
Dave?
So my first take on autonomous vehicles is they're completely terrifying. Because we're building into them these computers that are the most stunningly insecure devices you can hardly imagine. I mean, you know, at least a lock, you have to physically be there with a key in order to actually make it do something it didn't want to do. Whereas now everything is updated over the air and it's supposed to be a good thing. And it is a good thing until it's a terrible thing. And I don't, you know, I'm in a minority on this issue, and I can put the issue of security aside and talk about, you know, I had a rental car last week that had a bunch of this lane keeping stuff in it. I hadn't played with it before. I'm no expert as far as that goes, but you know, I understood how it worked, and hey, it's slowing down because somebody cut in front of me. That's kind of cool. I enjoyed that. That was all right. I didn't feel threatened by that. So I'm not worried so much about when things are working as they're supposed to, although that is an issue. I'm much more worried about when things are not working as they're supposed to. And it seems to me we're not, as a society and as an industry, focusing on that enough.
So, and to be clear, Dave is skeptical of computer systems in general, right? As a computing expert, he's thought long and hard about the vulnerabilities of computing systems, since an autonomous vehicle is essentially a computing system with a V8 engine. It's all the scary things that can happen with computing systems, and it's extremely heavy, extremely fast device that can actually cause damage.
Right. That's what makes it extra scary. It's bad enough to say, ha ha, I took over your screen. It's much worse to then drive through a plate glass window into a store and knock people over, that sort of thing.
No, that's great. And so I was wondering, since you both have different backgrounds, what have you done that's research related or that's related to autonomous vehicles?
I haven't done squat. I'll go first. you have to really squint and reach back to the level of doing machine learning in any fashion. Because all of these systems these days, all of these sensory perceptive systems are all using machine learned stuff somewhere in the loop. And so that's, you know, to the degree that I have any expertise at all, and Michael is far more expert than I am, it would be in sort of machine learning as a way to build systems that have specific narrow expertise one way or another.
Is there anything you want to...
Sure. So part of my role here at Brown is co-director of the Humanity-Centered Robotics Initiative. And so we do some stuff with robots, and I am particularly interested in machine learning, as Dave was talking about, as applied to robots. We haven't done self-driving cars per se. It's a very expensive kind of research to do, right? Because you need to buy a car. Cars are not cheap. But we've definitely experimented with questions of, you know, what it would mean for someone to give feedback to a self-driving vehicle. What can we say about how accepting people will be of you know, these kinds of experiences? And so mostly what I've thought about is building AI systems in general, not specifically applied to the autonomous vehicle direction.
Can you give me an example of what you mean by feedback?
Yeah, so how would you create a self-driving car? So if a self-driving car is essentially a kind of computer program that takes as input information about what kind of objects are around the car and produces as output a direction to set the steering wheel and a speed to set the accelerator, then what we're talking about is a kind of program, and how do we actually construct these programs? And so one way to build that people have built programs is by writing them, is by sitting down and saying, all right, here's the different conditions that I need to be able to test for. Here's the different rules that say, given these conditions, what should happen next. And this is primarily how the self-driving cars have been created, more or less up to this time, at least the original ones were very much hand-coded, right? So the decisions about what should I do in this kind of situation were according to rules that software engineers expressed. But another way to do it is with machine learning. And machine learning is something that says, okay, well, there's a couple different ways that I can build this mapping from sensing to acting. One way is to try to mimic someone. So have someone drive around and, well, the person saw this kind of information out in the world and then responded by steering in this direction. Okay, cool. Well, we'll make a mapping that does something like what the person did. And that's kind of the classic machine learning perspective on anything, but in particular on autonomous vehicles. I also think about the question of, well, what about giving feedback to the car? What about saying to the car, you know, that thing you just did, I didn't like it. Or, you know, you got me to my destination on time. I really appreciate that. Thank you very much. And so that kind of feedback can also be very valuable to improving the mapping from sensing to acting. And so when I was talking about feedback, it was that sort of thing that I had in mind.
So why do you think autonomous vehicles are being talked about so much now? Why is this becoming a hotter and hotter topic in current day?
So from the perspective of why people talk about things, people talk about a lot of things. Game of Thrones was extremely popular. So I don't, there isn't necessarily broader societal currents that influence that. However, I mean, the fact that this technology has been demonstrated now, and it's very striking. It's very exciting to watch a video of a car just like steering itself and driving around and doing reasonable things and stopping when a ball bounces in front of it, and, you know, and accelerating out from the stop sign. And I think the fact that people have actually built these things now really raises the question of, well, wait a second, what impact would this have on society more generally? What impact will this have on people's jobs? And I think there's just a lot of trends like that happening in society at large, where the question of how automation is going to impact jobs, this is just a particularly visible and striking one. Dave?
Well, you know, absolutely. There's a lot of investment going into it, and basically anything that's getting a lot of investment is going to get some talk, or at least within a few years of the investment's going to get some talk. But hey, I am ready to stop driving. I don't need to drive more. So if I could believe that this car was not going to kill me or kill anybody and leave me with liability, I would jump right in there. So, you know, I see the appeal. I just, you know, also see the terror.
That's great. So just to get a bigger sense of like autonomous vehicles in general. So the vision you could say is, let's say that you need to drive to the grocery store. You don't have a car, you know, but you instead can call an autonomous vehicle company to pick you up, and it, you know, drives through the city, avoids pedestrians, you know, goes down, you know, maybe your favorite route, and it gets you to your destination. And my question is, can you give me an overview on how this would work, you know, this whole pipeline or this whole product?
From like a computing standpoint?
Yes.
Dave, do you want to go first on this one?
Well, you know, it's certainly not something I'm really that expert in. So you pick the wrong people to ask this question from one point of view. But from another point of view, it's Uber, it's Lyft. It's exactly what we already have. It's a platform play in the cloud that is taking these requests and is watching with its God mode about where all its fleet is at and so forth, and figuring out how to say, okay, well, you know, this car is close to Dave's house. We'll send him there to pick him up. We'll tell him it'll be there in 2 minutes, and it'll be, you know, unit number 6943257, like that, because they won't have colors anymore. They'll all be the same. And whatnot. And so, you know, a lot of that, which was revolutionary over the last 10, 15 years, the whole platform play, Airbnb, all of these things are about, you know, making reputation systems so that you wouldn't feel insane to get in a stranger's car. And that is just going to be more of the same. It seems to me that you take out the human driver and you plop in this incredibly terrifying software, and the rest of the system sort of keeps on going.
Right. And I would just elaborate on that a little bit by saying that if you look at the system now, as Dave was pointing out, these rideshare programs, the system as a whole, like not human beings, but just the electronics, the infrastructure, is making a lot of the decisions about which car is going to be sent to which location and even by which route, right? So if you actually watch people when they're driving you in one of these rideshare cars, they're being told, like, turn left at the next light. The only thing that they need to do is translate that instruction about, oh, turn left at the next light, you know, without running over any cats or children, into actual actions on the car. And with the self-driving car technology, the autonomous vehicle technology, that can easily be replaced by a computing system. So then you have the whole end-to-end system set up that way.
I don't know if it could be easily replaced, but people are telling us it can be replaced.
Yeah, and it's worth noting, I don't know if you're going to ask a question about this later, but yesterday I took a ride in a self-driving car just to get a sense, to be, you know, prepared for this conversation. Like, what is it actually like? And it's not what I thought.
Can you tell me more about that whole experience? Who were you with?
Yeah, so Providence. I live in Providence, Rhode Island, and in Providence there is a pilot program called Little Roadie, which is a autonomous vehicle shuttle that takes someone from, for example, the Providence train station to an area of Providence called Olneyville, and then maybe back to the train station. So there's five vehicles, and they run in a loop on this route just all day. They, of course, have a human driver in there as well for various reasons. And so it wasn't surprising to us when we got to the shuttle to look inside, and there was a person sitting in the driver's seat. There was no steering wheel per se, but there was a little T-bar thing that was clearly a steering wheel that didn't look like a steering wheel. And when we got into the car, and it was clear that the driver was actually driving, he was pulling out of the spot and then moving into traffic and then handling the stoplight, we asked him, what's going on with this? And he said, oh, this one's not autonomous. It's not working properly. It's going to rain. And so that to me didn't sound like a good reason for not being autonomous if it was an actual autonomous shuttle that I was taking specifically to find out what it's like to be an autonomous shuttle. It turns out it's at least as deployed currently in Providence, very, very brittle. It doesn't want bad weather conditions. It turns out there are bad weather conditions in Providence. It rains, it snows, it gets dark, like things happen in Providence, and you really want a system to be robust to that. Apparently this one's not. And in addition, the hardware that's so important for scanning the area to make sure that the system's going to be you know, safe and knows what's coming ahead of it, is a set of laser rangefinders that are mounted in the front of the car and on the sides of the car, and I think on the back of the car. So it gets a 360-degree view of where all the other vehicles are. That hardware is extremely expensive and also brittle and was not working properly on, they said, 4 of the 5 cars that are making the loop right now aren't working. The fifth one is working, but the autonomous mode is turned off right now. We're really sorry. So all 5 of the cars were being driven by people as part of this pilot program. And he reassured me, don't worry, we are collecting data, except when it's raining, then we can't collect data. So it all sounded very...
Mechanical Turk.
Well, yeah, a little bit. Mechanical Turk, but also out of sync with the way that it gets often described. That this is something that's imminently happening and jobs are going to disappear, people are going to be replaced. But the fact of the matter is that, you know, there's a lot of people employed to be driving these shuttle buses around that are supposed to be driving themselves.
That's very interesting. Could you maybe talk a little about what you perceive as the public perception towards autonomous vehicles versus what you think the current state of the art is?
Right. So it's I guess, unfair, right, to ask me about the public perception. Like, I know my perception, and I see what's being written about in the popular press. And there, yeah, I think that the sense that people have, well, for example, there is the presidential candidate who's running for, well, president, I guess that's what presidential candidates do, who was an actual Brown University graduate, so one of our alums, who is out there saying basically everything is going to get overturned imminently. And if you don't elect him as president or someone as president who's going to be thinking through what are the issues about the future of all these drivers that are going to be replaced, then we're going to have an economic disaster on our hands. And so I think from that perspective, there are people really beating this drum saying this is happening, you know, any day now. You know, all Elon Musk has to do is flip a switch and all the Teslas are going to be driving themselves everywhere. And that's not really what's happening. So that my sense is that there is a bit of a disconnect between what we're hearing from people who would like us to believe that this is about to happen and we should be investing in it or we should be preparing for it in some way, and the reality, which is there's a lot that has to still be worked out.
Is there anything you'd like to say about that, Dave?
That sounds right to me. Every new technology gets talked up way beyond the level of maturity that it's already at. There's this cycle where, you know, it's amazing, it's cool, it's ordinary, it's invisible, it's forgotten. And, you know, self-driving cars are at this absolute amazing thing like that. And as Michael found, that, you know, the reality is significantly much less than that. And before it gets to the point where it's just automatic technology that you don't even see anymore, like traffic lights or something like that, it's a long, long road that we have to go down.
So speaking about that, how would you define what is called disruptive technology?
Well, you know, disruptive technology is a successful technology. I mean, it's not like there's, maybe there is, I'm not sure what to think of as an example, of a technology that does not displace some other way of doing the same thing. So when we say it's disruptive, all we're really saying is it's got better price performance than whatever was doing it before. So all the people that had, you know, donkeys pulling trucks, pulling wagons down the road, got displaced when the canal people came in and could move tons and tons of traffic down the canals at a fraction of the cost per mile. So it was very disruptive. Those poor donkey, mule, wagon guys were bombed. And so the same thing that we're dealing with now. I mean, the threat of automation is that it can sort of be a broadside against a whole range of jobs sort of all at once, rather than just the donkey, mule, wagon drivers. It's everybody. It's the lawyers, and next they're coming for you name it. They're coming for it. And I think there's a germ of truth to that. I think also it's much further down the road than people think, but society's going to have to deal with it one way or another. Absolutely.
I was just going to say, do you think we're in an AI bubble, or do you think this is... progress is going to last.
We are certainly in an AI bubble, but that doesn't mean that it's not real, and it doesn't mean that it won't last for a bit longer. I guess, I mean, Dave could speak to this to some degree, but both of us have seen the, you know, multiple rises and falls of certain of these technologies, and we're back at a peak, and it's very exciting, but, you know, it's hard not to look back and think, yeah, this is going to turn down too. Everything seems to turn down, especially when, in some cases, the talk isn't really matching up with the current reality. That there's going to be, it's going to be a while before we can really get this stuff to work. Just to elaborate a little bit on what Dave was saying in terms of disruptive technology, right? So I think he made a really great point, which is that all technology is disruptive. It's a matter of degree, and so to the extent that some of these technologies really, you know, shake up big chunks of the economy, that's really disruptive. And autonomous vehicles could definitely be that, right? It's so much of what we do is vehicle-centric, is car-centric in one way or another. And so if this technology really takes off, it will have profound repercussions on the workforce, the economy, society at large.
So I have, so RethinkX is an independent think tank that analyzes and forecasts the speed and scale of technology-driven disruption. And so I have what their executive summary of the autonomous vehicle paper. And so I want to read you just an excerpt, and I'm going to ask you what you think about this. So it says, states, "We are on the cusp of one of the fastest, deepest, and most consequential disruptions of transportation in history. By 2030, within 10 years of regulatory approval of autonomous vehicles, 95% of U.S. passenger miles traveled will be served by on-demand autonomous electric vehicles owned by fleets, not individuals, in a new business model we call transportation as a service." I was wondering what you think about this statement.
I definitely think that's a possible future. I think that we need to be a little bit circumspect, a little bit skeptical of these kinds of predictions, because the people making them aren't the ones building the technology, and they don't know what all the possible barriers are. So they don't know that it's going to be really hard to handle, you know, Providence winters. And so if you can't handle Providence winters, you can't handle Buffalo winters. If you can't handle Buffalo winters, you can't handle Montreal winter. Like there's going to be knock-on effects of technical barriers. There's going to be knock-on effects of technical barriers that we don't see yet. If we knew how to do it, we would just do it. And so some of this is still exploratory. And so I would at least take it with a grain of salt. If everything goes according to plan, that all sounds like a very sensible and reasonable path. But the future is what is. It's hard to make predictions, especially about the future.
Well, you know, people make money making these kind of predictions, and so that's fine. And they word them carefully. So that statement was worded in terms of passenger miles, for example. So we could just like ignore Providence completely and hardly matter in the passenger miles.
If it were just Providence, but Providence is not, you know, that different from other cities.
The airport to Midtown or whatever it is like that, we can get 20% of the passenger miles right there or something. I don't know. I'm making up numbers, but you get the idea. And I think that's probably optimistic, but it might not be that optimistic. Who knows? And we might have screwed ourselves over as a society much worse than it would take to. I mean, that's assuming that everything gets held together and there actually is progress and so forth. So I hope they're right. I suspect they're not.
Yeah, so I know Michael's brought up things about autonomous vehicles being able to make decisions for us. Very nice. I know Dave has brought up some safety concerns. So I'd like to ask on both spectrums, what do you see as the both pros and cons of autonomous vehicles entering our society at mass?
Sure. All right. Do you want to split it pros and cons, Dave, or do you want to do both, and then I'll do both?
I can't not do both.
Okay, good. Perfect.
You know, so I would say the pros are I wouldn't have to drive, and that's good. The cons are, It's going to take a long time, and people are going to get run over, and cars are going to burn down, and there's going to be all kinds of new failure modes that have to get worked out of the system. And the only way they get worked out of the system is by happening. And, you know, if we can keep it to this, the level where we can get a lot of the tale of unexpected circumstances, of which rain and snow are just the beginning. If we can start to pound out a lot of that stuff, then that's good. And, you know, if, as far as I'm concerned, the completely separate issue of what's going to happen when these cars start to get hacked in volume for purposes of terrorism or whatever, I don't see how that doesn't happen. And I just wish, hope we can get to a soft landing, hope that we get enough small incidences of this sort of thing that people say, hey, we have to change how we're engineering these systems. So that's me beating on the security drum one more time. But at the same time, I want to be able to jump in one of these cars. That's the problem.
Yeah, I think one of the positives that is often trumpeted is the notion of increasing safety, right? So the idea that people can get where they're going efficiently and safely, it could, you know, decrease pollution, it could decrease wear and tear, we could really benefit from the sharing of vehicles. A lot of the vehicles that we have are just parked most of the time, and so if we're actually sharing them because they, you know, are efficiently getting us from place to place to place, then those resources are going to be used more effectively, and therefore there's more, yeah, there's just less pollution, there's less space taken up in our built-up society for the vehicles to just sit there. They could just be moving more of the time, and they can be parked way off-site. My kids are learning to drive. I guess my son now drives, and my daughter is not yet driving. But they're terrible. No, that's a mean thing to say. But I worry about them because they're terrible. So they're gonna get in an accident, and somebody's gonna get hurt. And I really would rather that not happen. And so I've been kind of crossing my fingers, hoping that the autonomous vehicles would get into place before my kids really had to be behind the wheel. That's not quite happened. Those are all big positives. I think there's the negatives. There's definitely some concerns about how should the autonomous vehicles handle a traffic cop? Like there's some construction or something happening, and someone has to hand direct the car around the traffic. That means really understanding what they're trying to get you to do. And if the car has a rule that says, you know, you stay on the road, and then a person's pointing, saying you need to, you know, like go over on the shoulder, like how is it going to understand that? And there's just many, many levels of things that driven cars do that we just haven't made commonplace and automatable at this point. So I'm worried about that. And then there's, boy, I mean, I think the whole like social media thing has really freaked me out a bit, in the sense that I watched, you know, some of my students and peers, people who I really respect, highly technically skilled people, go out and build these tools with the best of intentions of, we're going to connect people, we're going to make it easier for people to communicate and share ideas, and to see how in many ways it's been co-opted by disruptive forces, by dangerous forces. I can't imagine that wouldn't be some way. People are super clever, that people are going to hack this, that people are going to take advantage of this system, whatever we put into place, for their own benefit. So whenever there's a change in technology, there are people who are just waiting to take, you know, to jump into the loopholes and make things better for themselves, but worse for everyone else. And it just takes us a while to figure out how to close those loopholes. And so in the interim, there's going to be pain. That's my sunny outlook.
Well, there will be a follow-up on that in a little bit. I'm going to segment or transition back to the technological aspects just to get us all on board again. So there's a blog post written by Todd Littman, the other Littman, no, just kidding, called The Many Problems with Autonomous Vehicles. And so he describes what's called the Zombie Kangaroo Costume Challenge. Have you heard of it?
I have not.
Okay. Nope. Okay. Zombie Kangaroo Costume Challenge is, he quote, people can usually interpret and respond appropriately to such situations. If I say, watch out for teenagers in zombie kangaroo costumes, you could probably understand the threat, but a computer would be baffled. That particular situation is too unusual to be included in the standard risk database. And I was wondering if you... Can you explain the zombie kangaroo costume problem just in lay people terms?
Well, I would hope the car would be programmed, when it encounters something it doesn't recognize, it won't run it down. So, okay, who cares that it doesn't realize that that's a teenager in a zombie costume or whatever it is, because it'll avoid it anyway. I mean, the problem is if you have a teenager in a, in a costume that looks like a road with an arrow pointing forward, well, that's going to be a worse case. But then you could get mowed down by people just as well. I'm not sure that I really see the premise that because wacky things could happen, therefore the car is going to mow them down or whatever.
So, okay, so to try to restate the challenge in my own words. So it sounds like you could tell a human driver, look, there's this sort of weird festival going on where people get dressed up in zombie kangaroo costumes. You know, they when they're in that mode, they kind of wander into the road, like in a weird, unpredictable way, and you should, like, not hit them. So just be on alert. So with an autonomous vehicle, they're always on alert. And so as Dave points out, they're not going to just hit something that is weird and surprising. On the other hand, this is not where we are today. Where we are today, the cars just drive very defensively. So they'll go more slowly if they're not on the highway. If there are pedestrians walking around, some of these cars will make the assumption that a person could at any point in time change how they're walking so that they're going maximum speed in an arbitrary direction. And that could be right in front of the car. And so they're always trying to drive in such a way that if that happens, they will have time to stop. And they're actually thinking about this. They're actually computing these hypothetical paths. But that's, it leads to cars that drive very slowly. So one thing that I asked the little roadie drivers who I met in the shuttle, in my inability to actually go in an autonomous vehicle, is I asked them, how does the car drive differently than you do? What are some instances where the car does something that you think, I wouldn't have done it that way? And a lot of it comes down to the cars drive very conservatively. When they take a turn, they slow down. They say that the drivers are telling us that other vehicles will honk at them. And so them as human drivers are very, very anxious. And some of them even now, when they see a turn coming, will stop the autonomous mode, switch into manual mode, do the turn themselves, and then turn it back over to the car because they just don't like the feeling of everybody being annoyed at them. So this is the way that the cars work now, is they just assume the worst at all times. Or they assume, well, what's going to have to happen is they're going to have to switch over to something more like the average at all times. Like, mostly people don't jump into traffic, so if you're going to be a reasonable driver, you need to just assume that mostly people are not going to jump into traffic. Well, if there is the zombie kangaroo challenge in effect, where suddenly, people are going to jump into traffic. They're undead, but they are jumping, and they are in traffic, and you're going to have to do something about that. Right, a person could now adapt their model to say, normally, I would not assume that this individual who's an obstacle is going to cut in front of the car, but today I should make that assumption, and I should modulate my driving accordingly. Yeah, we don't have a way to do that. But the fix at the moment is to have the cars drive very conservatively.
So from someone who's maybe more of a layperson who doesn't have so much background in machine learning or even necessarily in the truck driving industry, is there anything you'd want to say to them in terms of prepping them for that they should know more about in terms of what's coming forward? Is there something you'd like to kind of get out there in terms of what they should be more knowledgeable about or what they should be looking for?
It's a really interesting question. Nothing comes to mind. I mean, like, it's hard to know how to prepare because we don't know exactly how this technology is going to be deployed, right? So if it is something where you're essentially, there's a fleet of cars and you're a passenger, the car pulls up in front of you, maybe the door opens, you climb in, it closes, like, that's going to be probably, I mean, it's going to be a lot like taking an elevator, right? Once upon a time, there were humans that drove the elevator and then that got automated. And so now you push the button, the elevator comes, you get in the elevator, you don't have to know a lot, right, to be able to be an effective elevator user. It's like, don't stare at the person next to you, right? Like, you know, if you pass gas, make sure to apologize to people quickly because it's going to... Yeah, anyway, so there's things that you have to know, but the details, I don't think people need a lot of prep time for that. There is a high-level bit, which I think is people should continue to be skeptical until the world has done a legitimately good job of convincing us that this is a reasonable thing, right? And so that means... you know, pay attention to not just the people who are trying to sell you the service, but also pay attention to the people who are trying to evaluate the service and take a you know, a moderate, balanced view. That's useful in the interim. Once it gets deployed, if it's actually safe and things are going well, no, I can't think of anything that people need to know at this point.
Yeah, I guess the only thing to know is it's going to take longer than everybody says. I mean, one thing, maybe this is going back to a con that I forgot to complain about last when we were talking about pros and cons, but a worry about the ways that self-driving cars, autonomous vehicles may develop is if you have these hard problems, like Michael talked about, of a policeman with his white gloves pointing to tell people to take a right, even though it means cutting across a corner. The solution that we would like is we would like the autonomous vehicles to be smart enough to figure out that's what's going on and obey appropriately. But a simpler way to do it is to outlaw cops with white gloves. And instead, the only way you can have a construction site is by having radio transponders that are broadcasting to the autonomous vehicles saying that there's been a change in the road status, blah, 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 blah. And it reminds me of the dawn of regular internal combustion cars 110 years ago, where now these cars were going much faster than anybody used to be and so forth. And so the previous pattern of having pedestrians just wandering around and crossing the street wherever they felt like, because here's where the store they were in and there's the store they wanted to get to. They're both in the middle of the block, so they cross the street. That became problematic for cars. And in fact, I understand I read about this some time ago that, you know, there was an actual campaign to introduce the concept of jaywalking and to make the idea that jaywalking was a bad thing, to try to drive that as a social evil to make life easier for cars. And they weren't even autonomous cars at that point, but they were big, heavy, mechanical things that people were moving around quickly. And so there's reason to expect that something like that might recapitulate with self-driving cars, that anything that would be hard for them, we will eliminate from the road as a matter of law, insurance, or what have you, rather than trying to solve the AI problem that Michael was talking about being so difficult, which it is.
Hmm. Okay. Yeah, that's very interesting. On the other side of things, do you think that there should be anything policymakers should be looking at or something they should be better understanding about this problem moving forward? If not lay people not being able to be able to change appropriately, how is there anything that we as a society should be trying to prepare for?
I'd say two words to give to policymakers and two words to give to the man in the street to claim to yell at the policymakers about. And the two words are software liability. That when you distribute software to make money, you should not be able to disclaim the fact that it doesn't do the job. And software makers, you know, every software company is desperately afraid of this and says it'll completely stifle innovation and XYZ. And to some degree, it will. And to some degree, it should. And, you know, folks that are doing open source or whatever, they're not making money off of distributing the stuff. And so software liability would not fall upon them. If their software got incorporated into something that somebody sold, well, then it would fall upon the person who sold it. Software liability is what we need to be pushing to the policy books.
And just to connect the dots on that a little bit, right? Since the cars, all the decisions that the cars are making are going to be software driven, there's a lot riding on the correctness, right? And the reliability of that software. And so at the moment, you know, when you buy a new piece of software, you can click through saying, oh yeah, yeah, yeah. If this doesn't work as intended, like that's on me, the consumer. And so Dave is saying this model is probably terrible now, but it's inherently, deeply, irretrievably terrible when we go to something like a self-driving car situation. And I think there's a lot of reasons to be nervous about this. I was on a panel with a representative from the National Highway Safety Transportation Administration. I got the letters out of order, but like someone who works with the government who is concerned about, whose focus is on car travel, vehicle travel. And from her perspective, she was viewing her job as primarily being, how can we make it easier for the car manufacturers to make this happen? right? I would have always assumed that their main thing would be our safety, right? And so the car manufacturers would be pushing to get the cars onto the road, and the government agencies would be saying, okay, but you need to really convince us that this is safe. That wasn't the top of their agenda. Their top of their agenda was making sure that the car companies didn't have to push, that it was just easy as pie for this next phase to happen. And, you know, well, presumably the car companies will make sure it's safe because it's in their best interest. So that really concerned me that at the moment the government wants to try to make this happen, I think for really good reasons, but in some ways they might be abdicating their responsibility. So I want to make sure that policymakers are really aware of their critical role in making sure that this vehicle is going to have all the upsides and as few of the downsides as possible.
And then lastly, what would you say to the consumers of autonomous vehicles?
I'm sorry, to what?
The consumers, the people who will be taking the autonomous vehicles.
Yeah, I don't think they're edible.
Wait,
I don't know. Yeah. It seems like it's going to be a while before there's going to be a lot of autonomous vehicles to consume. So I guess I would say don't hold your breath.
Oh, that's a good point. Right. If to the people who are not teaching their kids to drive because, you know, any minute now there's going to be this replacement.
Right.
Yeah, they should probably just get out there and do it.
To speak to random parents with kids who might be learning to drive.
I don't know. There's such people. I know some people in my house.
So maybe it's just like a general recap, and feel free to get as nuanced as you'd like, but to really direct to the question, should we as a society be worried about autonomous cars right now, and for what reason or not?
So I do think it's super smart for us as a society to be talking about the impacts of automation and trying to set things up so that we get the benefits of automation, which generally makes society as a whole richer, while mitigating the cost, while mitigating the pain and suffering that are accrued to the people whose, for example, jobs get replaced. And I don't think we have a good system in place for doing that. And so I think the fact that we're talking about self-driving cars in this way and maybe having this conversation is a good thing. And I think we need to make it even more serious. I was listening to a podcast where the guest was saying, you know, this is the number one question, not self-driving cars per se, but what's your perspective on automation and society is the number one question we should be asking presidential candidates in this election, not even election year, election huge block that now we have to all suffer through. But to get people, make sure that people are actually talking about it and considering it.
Yeah, that's what I think too. I don't think anything specific about self-driving cars, because mostly because they're not really here yet, but the issues of automation are here, and they're already being disruptive, as you were talking about before, and they're going to get more so. So I agree with Michael that the thing to be doing is to be broadening the conversation out to policy. Is it a basic income guarantee? Is how are we going to live when it's not necessarily about either our physical muscles with our hands or our relatively routinized, repeated actions with our brains that is going to make us money. And because both of those stand to be automatable in vast numbers in the next decades or two.
Yeah. Talking about that, do you see there being a larger problem that needs to be addressed or a specific industry besides transportation that will be hit first with regards to automation robotics that you worry more about that will be solved along the way to getting to full autonomous vehicles? Or do you see autonomous vehicles as kind of the first thing that we'll have to really make that address those kind of problems regarding automation and robotics in our society?
Michael?
So I'm loath to predict the exact ordering of these things, but there's a bunch that are kind of on the chopping block at the moment, and transportation is definitely one of them. People talk about radiology as being an important one, and I think there's aspects of that. I think in all cases, there's aspects that really are very routinizable and are in the short run, we're going to have systems that can do it. But all of them also have a lot of subtlety that I think the people who are so certain that this is easily replaced. Now that we have the technology, it's just a matter of, like, you know, people training for something else. I don't think that's true. I think that there's subtleties in being disruptive in the way that we were talking about before that that people just don't appreciate. We have to go through the exercise and actually make it happen to know. And so, yeah, there are definitely other fields. I mean, boy, you know what I'm most worried about? Journalism, right? So journalism, it wasn't really AI that crushed journalism, but it was easy, free communication that made it very difficult for the previous business model of journalists to be preserved. And now that it's not preserved, I think we're seeing some very negative repercussions of that. And so, yeah, not only are a lot of people with journalism degrees out of a job, but we're not actually getting the same, you know, quality of service that we used to. And so, I think there's this broader question of automation. There's a bunch of fields where this is likely to happen first. I don't know which one is going to actually hit.
Yeah, I think journalism is a good example, right? Because Craigslist came and ate the classified ads, which was, in fact, I understand, what was paying for all the journalism. And that can happen over and over again. I mean, so the simple form filling that law offices used to do wills and so on and so forth are now increasingly being automated or do it yourself or online websites and so forth. And that takes none of the subtlety and the deep experience of legal reasoning and so forth, but it was the bread and butter that used to pay for keeping the lights on so that you could have the incredibly subtle super duper Perry Mason lawyering and so on. And so there's going to be this continued pattern of the low hanging fruit that used to pay for the exotic expertise getting eaten up by the automation. And even though the automation will not be able to do the exquisite subtlety stuff, the question is, how do we keep the exquisite subtle stuff alive in order to get it to deal with the tail that automation cannot deal with? And I don't have a real good answer for that. I mean, especially for cars, because, I mean, you know, I don't know, maybe you could have expert drivers with VR goggles or something, and when the autonomous car got in trouble, a human would cast their brain into it and drive it out of the steer or something, out of the skid. It seems unlikely. The turnaround time is a little bit too short. But for a lot of fields, it could work that way. And, you know, maybe there, if we, instead of, you know, doing the artificial intelligence, the AI, if we try to imagine the IA, the intelligent assistance, the intelligent amplification, where we would say, okay, well, so XYZ law firm will have its own automated component that will do wills for you, just like doctor's offices have all of these skilled assistants that do the blood draws and so forth for you, or dentist's office, same thing. And then eventually the subtle expert person runs the whole thing and takes ultimate responsibility and glances at the result. Maybe that would be a way to have keep some control over the spread of automation rather than having it be the platform play, the Uber for your teeth, the Airbnb for your insides, whatever it happens to be. I don't know. Even in the best case scenario, we're going to need a lot less lawyers, a lot less XYZs, because we took out all of the sort of routine stuff and gave it to automation.
I'm just going to follow up and say, what should we pay attention to as society to prevent job displacement?
What should we pay attention to?
As a society to prevent job displacement.
Oh. Well, as an individual, I would say, you know, get a good liberal education, learn how to land on your feet when the situation changes. I don't think you can stop the situation from changing. So you want to be able to say, well, you know, I need to be able to find a job where we can sock away a little bit so that when we have to change situations, we change situations. I don't know.
Yeah, you phrased the question as, what do we do to stop job displacement? I think we want job displacement. I think what we don't want is for people's lives to be ruined by it. But job displacement is actually a really good thing, because it's generally they're getting replaced by jobs that are more successful or more efficient or somehow better serving. I think there's a subtle point that Dave was raising that I really like. I hadn't really heard that articulated before, which is the idea that in some sense, one of the things that technology and automation is allowing us to do is unbundle things that services that used to be provided as a big clump, like a newspaper gives you news about the world. It gives you news about the high school. It gives you scores from sports, and it gives you the classified ads. they can be unbundled. And when they become unbundled, then in some cases, if the business model was, well, the classifieds kind of cover, you know, carry for everybody because people are paying to put them in and people are paying to read them. And so we're getting double paid for this. We don't have to actually produce anything. It's really easy for us. But we then can use that money to support all these other services. With the unbundling, now the money goes with the one and is taken away from the others. And so in many cases, I think what we need to worry about, we do want to worry about job displacement, but we don't, but the subtle thing that we have to pay attention to that I think we miss sometimes is that when these industries get disrupted, we're sometimes sinking, we're not necessarily automating all the services. We're automating the easy services and sometimes the lucrative services while leaving behind the really valuable but, you know, hadn't really been paid for properly before services. And that's a problem for everybody.
So the last question is just to really tie back to your own background in artificial intelligence, robotics, and your careers, was that just, you know, in your experience, how slow does research progress, you know, go? And, you know, I guess in your, can you tell a story about like when it didn't meet expectations of society or, you know, maybe something like that, to talk about like how, we may be in a current bubble, you know? So how, in your experience, how have you dealt with being in a bubble or not being in a bubble?
As far as anything, I just try to keep my head down and do good work and try not to play into the bubble too much. So, you know, it's this dogged belief, all evidence to the contrary, that cream rises. And so you keep yourself clean, you put out good stuff, and people will get it or they won't. On the other hand, you know, I used to subscribe to these, you know, closed newspapers that would sell it, that were distributed for free into specific audiences to try to sell advertising for electrical engineers or whatever it happens to be. And, you know, every issue of these things was full of the most amazing technological breakthroughs, you know, memristors and spintronics and blue bleeblues and whatever it is. And I was like, oh, wow, that'd be really cool. I want to get some of those so I could play with it and do a new computing thing. And you never could. And eventually I just gave up on it. So, you know, the bubbles come and go. And everything takes longer. And so the sooner that you get adjusted to that, well, then the less disappointed you'll be by the progress of technology. I mean, so I did machine learning in the 1980s. And, you know, so it ought to be right around the corner. But it took 30 years before now here we are talking about it in your podcast with y'all. It takes a long time.
I went to a workshop at one point, I don't know, maybe 20 years ago, 15 years ago. And a person walked up to me who I knew but didn't know well. And he was holding the New York Times, some newspaper. And he said to me, so what are you going to do now that you're out of a job? I'm like, I didn't know I was out of a job. And I said, I don't know what you're talking about. He's like, now that quantum computers are here, every problem can be solved quickly. So there's really going to be no point in having, you know, programmers, right? We could just like have the programs write themselves. And he was totally serious. He was looking at me like, I want to know the answer to this. And I said, well, like, it's possible that that's the case. That's the world we live in now. But you know, I'm skeptical. And until I hear otherwise, I'm just going to keep doing my work. I'm going to do my job and use the kinds of computers that we have today to try to make things work better. And, you know, now 15, 20 years later, those computers are still really useful. They haven't been supplanted by quantum computers. And in fact, there's some reason to believe that some of the early hype about quantum computers was just completely made up and misunderstood. And so, yes, time goes by and, you know, the more things change, the more I'm still just doing regular conventional computing.
Okay, yeah, I think that's pretty much we wrap up. The only last thing is there anything about automation, robotics in society, or specifically about autonomous vehicles we didn't get to ask or cover today that you'd like to get out there or anything like that? Just any final thoughts you'd want to share?
Nothing's coming to mind. Mm-hmm. I feel like we covered a lot of stuff, which is great. You know, in general, people should be skeptical of hype, but optimistic, right? Like I don't want to say, oh, this is all just made up. Just assume everything's going to be bad. The world will always be bad. Because we need some optimism to just keep pushing forward. And when we push forward, good things do happen. But they happen slowly. And they happen through dint of hard work. And we just have to keep plugging along. So don't lose hope. But also don't think that the solution to all our problems is just around the corner. Because it's going to be a slog.
Yeah, I don't know that I have much to add. I feel like I've already said about 130% of what I know. But I guess I would end with a plug, right? I mean, if you want to learn a little bit about what might be an alternative to the entire approach of computing that underlies what people are using for self-driving vehicles, you might just go to Google and type in T2, the letter T and the number 2, the T2 Tile Project, and find the stuff that we're working on YouTube about an alternate way to compute.
Yeah, I also know you guys have your own podcast, Computing Up. Is there anything you'd like to say about that, plug that here?
Yes, you should all go listen to Computing Up.
Right, so Computing Up is a podcast that Dave and I put together that really is you taking a computational perspective on kind of the universe more broadly. It's not specific to any technologies. It's really thinking about, in some cases, very philosophical issues and how they're informed by our understanding of how to make machines do things.
Awesome. Great. Okay. Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, thanks for the invite.
Thanks, guys. Good luck.